This is Japan Baseball Weekly, the only English podcast covering all 12 NPB teams. And now, your hosts, John E. Gibson and Jim Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of November 30th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Sunday morning, bright and early, is Jim Allen. How you doing, bud?
I'm bright and early. I'm brighter and earlier than I was on Fangraphs the other day. That was, I don't know, sometimes insomnia has its benefits, I think.
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the chat. If you guys didn't hear, get a chance to listen to the Fangraphs podcast, check it out. Jim tweeted it out so you can find it that way, or you can just do a search. But I enjoyed the chat.
David Lorela is a friend of mine from the winter meetings, and he does a really good job. He's very understated. But they did a great job on the editing, so I sounded less of a doofus than I usually do.
Oh, well, that's always good.
Yeah.
You mean you usually do here on JBW?
He said, yeah, exactly.
Or
he said,
no.
he said that he'd take a bribe to make me sound better, but he didn't carry out his threat. He didn't ask for a bribe. He didn't actually demand a bribe to make me sound better. So thanks, Dave.
All right. Well, you sounded good, and it was a fun discussion, so enjoyed it. All right. Again, we always thank the frontline workers and everybody out there in the hospitals who are helping with this coronavirus. Thank you very much. It's peaking. It's getting higher all over the world, not just in one country. So we all need to be better.
Yes.
But everything I say here on the show is really helping. Anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, in our dream state, people listen to us.
Exactly. All right. On this week's show, we've got a chat with Carter Stewart Jr. of the Hawks. We're going to discuss SoftBank's double quadruple. And we're going to talk about the Sawamura Award, some of the free agents and poster boys, and touch on some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
So the double quadruple is two sweeps in the Japan series for their fourth consecutive Japan series. So the two sweeps is the double, and then the second quadruple is the fact that they have won four consecutive Japan series titles. And yeah, that was a mess. It probably doesn't. It's probably not that great a joke or a gag. But anyway, I did it. a couple of quick points. I was able to sit down with Carter Stewart Jr. of the SoftBank Hawks, and this is the second time this season we've had him on the show. Back in April, we spoke to him, and he basically has just completed his second year in NPB, all on the farm. This season, he went 3-7, a 4.16 ERA, threw 65 innings over 15 outings. But when you hear him talk, you'll hear him explain and talk about how he prepares, and I think more so than the results, I think he's working on some things, and I think you get that impression when you hear the chat. I just really think it's a unique opportunity for us to discuss the Hawks from a different perspective. We just had Matt Moore on last week. He goes out and has a really great game in the Japan series. So I think he's a one-year guy, so he's going to have a contract somewhere after that performance. So if not, you know, a longer-term one with the Hawks. But we've spoken with older players from the Hawks and older players throughout our time on JBW with more experience. So I thought getting the thoughts of a player who's trying to work his way up through the system is a rare opportunity for us to hear what their perspective is when they see the guys out there, their teammates, some of the guys who work, maybe some of the elevator guys who play on the farm sometimes, but then go back up to the top team and then come back down, and other players who are getting back into, maybe they've been deactivated and had an injury to deal with, and they play and they come back up, they go back up to the first team. So he gets to spend some time seeing those guys. He did say that he had seen Kodai Senga pitch early in the year. So it's just a different perspective. And, you know, we're getting used to the Hawks winning so much, and I think the Hawks are getting used to winning, but you get the idea that the whole team is still working toward winning, because different guys get shots. to play. And we saw that this year with the Hawks. There were different players and different heroes. Anyway, we spoke to him on Friday night, and it was a really good chat, so let's check it out. All right, we are glad to be joined by, we're actually very thrilled to be joined by Carter Stewart Jr. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us again this year.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I mean, I enjoyed being on here last time, so, it's just, talk baseball.
All right. Well, congratulations to you and the Hawks entire organization for yet another championship, and I'm sure it was really fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome being around some of the guys. You know, I wasn't there, but I was around a lot of the guys here. We watched the end of it. Obviously, it's a special opportunity to be on a team that's as good as we are. But yeah, it's obviously awesome. I mean, it'd be much more fun watching it from in person. But all I can do right now is root all those guys on. You know, some of my other foreigner, other foreigner that are friends. You know, root all the Japanese guys on and just keep winning.
Yeah, keep winning. That's what you guys keep doing. So I'm going to start with the most important question. I'm sure it's the burning question that all of our listeners want to know, and is do championship bonus shares extend to the farm team?
I have no clue. I really don't know.
I knew you were going to say that. But we had to ask, they have sales. They have all kinds of sales when teams win. And so I'm just wondering if, you get a little extra bonus in that Christmas check. But anyway, let's get down to business now. How did you actually celebrate the championship?
We didn't do anything too big. Right now, I'm at the Phoenix League, so everyone was happy texting each other. I was texting my interpreter. I was, seeing some of the guys. We were at dinner, but nothing too special yet. I imagine after the season, a lot of the guys will go out maybe to dinner or, do something more fun. But obviously, I can just be excited for the team in the situation I am now. I'm guessing in non-COVID years, there's a lot more celebration that would go on. Postseason, going out maybe on vacation. I remember they've gone to Hawaii before, but this year it's kind of just like, good job. It was an awesome season. Celebrate it while you have the opportunity, and then kind of get ready for next year.
That's right. What went through your mind as you watched the game and watched the guys finish off that sweep of the Giants in another Japan series?
I mean, it was pretty. It just proves how good of a team SoftBank is. Watching that series, watching both series, just watching this entire year, it's really impressive to watch a lot of those guys, especially because I've gotten to play around them just even a little bit. Mm-hmm. Showing the durability, the ability that all those guys have, them going out day after day, the performances by all the pitchers, a lot of these hitters are just tearing it up. It's pretty fun to watch.
It is. If you're not, an opponent or a fan of another team or something like that. But my philosophy is that the in-team competition matters, and it helps really make the overall team stronger. So, how was your year of development? Because you were playing with some of these guys who ended up contributing on the top team.
I got to play with a few of those guys. More than, a few notables like Sugiyama, I played around a lot. Shino, I was around a lot. Maybe not guys who were like contributed a ton. I was around Senga a little bit towards the beginning of the year and watched him throw. But, developmental wise, watching them and learning off them is always helpful. And I think kind of the overall of my development, I feel like I did a lot of good things well. I had a meeting today and I felt like there was a lot of good things that came out of it. There's a few small things. I feel at times that my breaking ball regressed a little bit, but I learned a hard slider, and I've learned how to throw my changeup more effectively. I've learned how to throw my fastball more effectively. I just think the main two things that I can take out of this year that I need to improve upon, or three things that I need to improve upon, always get stronger, get your core stronger, get more, flexible, stuff like that. And then, of course, the one big thing is I need to work on walks this year is get my walk numbers down. I felt like I was trying to work around guys too much this year, and I think it inflated my walks. And I think the last thing is just, striking more guys out. I think that I was getting a lot of 0-2, 1-2, 2-2 counts. I just wasn't able to finish guys off as well. They're very, very solid contact hitters over here, so you really have to make a pitch to strike guys out. Right. But those are three things that I kind of am going to focus on going into next year. I just get my mechanics more sound. But yeah, at this point, I feel like I developed pretty solid. I'm very happy with this year in the sense that I got a lot of experience mentally, physically, what a full season is like. I mean, this is really, if you think about it, this will probably be one of the hardest years of my career, of anybody who's playing baseball right now, their career, with how, you know, the COVID happened and everything. I've been here for almost 10 and a half months without seeing family or friends.
Sure, so yeah.
I've been able to, you know, toughen up and get through it. So now it's just a matter of, you know, next year, hopefully, with if things go get better, like COVID wise, I can keep getting better and maybe, you know, have an opportunity. So that's just that's kind of the mindset moving forward, to get stronger and give myself an opportunity.
Okay, so you answered my next two questions, but I did want to know, what are your expectations for reaching the top team sometime?
I mean, I try not to have any expectations. It's obviously the goal. The goal is to get to the Ichigun team. I think that going that this offseason is going to be big for my development, getting stronger. And once I get stronger, I mean, you look at all these guys in the big league team, they're extremely strong, durable, with lots of stamina. So that's, I need to create that, you know, that build, have a lot of stamina, create that strength. And I think that will help me, you know, develop my consistency. You know, well, the consistency helps with walks, and the consistency helps with, you know, each outing, you know, the ups and the downs, which will help me ultimately get to the Ichigun, in my opinion.
Right. Now, you touched on it a second ago, and I think so much of the game is mental. So how do the coaches help you develop on the mental side?
I think that really is there's only so much coaching that can go into it, especially in my situation.
You I think that you just kind of explain that too, but go ahead. Yeah,
I think that you just kind of have to go through it. A lot of things that I've gone through this year have been new to me. You know, being more alone, you know, trying to grind through every day. Just like all the, you know, the small aspects of every day, you know, making sure you do every little thing, waking up early, making sure you don't miss your alarm, you know, take a shower, eat something small, get to the field at a good hour. It's just like all the small stuff of the day that mentally you realize, you know, it starts to drain you more and more. And especially not having people around who, I mean, I love my guys on my team. I love all my teammates. Don't get me wrong. I think they're all all of them are fantastic guys. I love talking to them. I love learning about them. But, you know, just that missing of the, you know, not having family or friends there that I've known for 10, 15, 20 years, you know, my family.
Sure.
That definitely can make a little bit more strain on myself mentally, because those, like, even I know talking to them on the phone is nice and all, but I'm more of a person that shows physical / being with somebody in person is my, you know, type of interaction.
Being in Japan for 30 years, I know exactly what you're saying.
Exactly. So that made it a little bit harder mentally, but I grinded through it. Sometimes you just got to put your head down and you just got to get through it. It's like anything you do in life, in my opinion, you just got to get through it. And then the development, like coaching, helping my mental aspect, they helped me a lot mentally on the mound, in the sense of facing batters, mentally how to approach guys. Mentally how to deal with ups and downs, mentally how to deal with inning to inning, pitch to pitch, out to out. They kind of taught me how to, like, Japan's a very, I don't know if neutral is the right word, but they're very on average. Like, everything stays on a line, you know? Their emotions stay on a line. They don't get too up, they don't get too down. They can throw a perfect game and just be on that, you know, the emotional line. So that's right. Kind of what they taught me is that every, you know, you can't be emotional up there. You know, you can how you get fired up. You can get pissed off, but you got to stay inning to inning, out to out, pitch to pitch. You got to stay at the same place. You got to stay consistent.
Yeah, I like that. I like that approach. I was somewhat emotional, but only mostly negative stuff. If things were going wrong, I played basketball mostly. So if things were going wrong, I was really on my teammates and on the referees. But if things were going well, I was pretty quiet.
Okay.
So I know what you're talking about. Now, when I see players for the Hawks come up to the top team, yeah, I know they've been tested in multiple ways because it's not easy to make it through their system and get up to the top team. You know, the physical aspects are part of it, but there's also so much talent in that organization. How do you evaluate the other pitchers in the system? Because you're basically in competition with some of them to get up to the top team.
Exactly. I don't think the thing is with like the guys on my team, it's hard to say that I'm competing against them in the sense that, like, I'm trying to take their spot. I root for all those guys. I think that, you know, I want all those guys to succeed as well. I think, obviously, at the beginning of the season when I'm throwing against them, maybe like an inner squad or something, I want to beat them in that sense. But, you know, I root for those guys. But that since I'm rooting for those guys, that makes me have to get better than them, you know? Even right. I want them to be the best that they can be, but I got to be better than that if I want to have that opportunity over them. There is the competition. There is that, you know, wanting to be in if you see these guys in that spot, you want to be in their spot, but I can't look at them like, oh, you know, I hope they throw bad so I take their spot. No, I want to throw good enough so I want to be in that spot.
That's awesome. Yeah, that is. I mean, obviously, you, like I said, you know, the people say iron sharpens iron. Mm-hmm. And so you can't have poor competition on the team. You have to root for someone to do better than they usually do, and then you to top that, so exactly. that you can, so that everybody can prove. And I just get a sense that that's what's going on at SoftBank, because we were talking about it last week as we were watching the team win the first two games of the Japan series. It's not like the players themselves are that much better than the other players that they're going up against, the opponents, but they certainly bring their best games when their best games are required.
Exactly. And
how is that mental preparation? Or, you know, because Kudo, I heard Kudo say that all the players really got ready to play and they were mentally and physically prepared to play. How do you go about doing that and being at that top of your game when there's a challenge before you?
I think that it's just all in the preparation, all in the practice. I think that as long as you prepare well, you don't skip reps, and you practice well, you don't skip exercises, skip reps, you don't flake out, you don't throw in a bullpen, you go after it, you pitch by pitch instead of just going up there and just throwing. I think that's how you prepare. I think it all comes down to practice. I think the best games I had this year is when I practiced and prepared extremely well.
All right. Now, how much are analytics part of the process for you personally as you're working? Do you go through a lot of the numbers and things that you can measure after you throw?
A little bit. Before outings, I'll do a little bit of analytical work. I'll look at past outings versus the team, you know, hot and cold zones, stuff like that. And then post outings, besides video, I'll look at some track. We have a lot of TrackMan stuff. Spin rate, velo. I'll try to keep up with the numbers as best I can, make sure that I stay consistent with them. I don't look at numbers a ton. I look a little bit at extension, arm angle, and then spin rate, velo is kind of like the main stuff I look at in terms of like analytical stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I know it's getting big, but I always say, hey, look, people aren't just good because they have good analytics. They're good because they're good, and the analytics prove it. You know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You can't get better just because you got the analytics working in
your favor. Correct. I mean, that's completely right, though.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I played sports. I mean, I know you can't say go up there and try to get a lot of spin on this pitch and then you're going to get the out. That's not how it works. Mm-hmm. All right, one last question. May we have you on the show again next year?
Of course. I'm coming back next year. I mean, I'm just quote-unquote technically signed. Not technically signed. I'm going to be here next year, as everyone expected. But yeah, I'll be here next year. I'll just keep trying to develop. You know, the plan or the goal is to get to the Ichigun level and perform and play there. But I'm going to do everything I can. I'm going to try to get stronger. I'm going to try to get better on the mound. I'm going to try to have, my walks better, strike out guys more. Just get more consistent up there. And if I think I can do that, you know, I'm going to give myself an opportunity. And that's the biggest thing I can do for myself, is give myself an opportunity to play at that level. And, you know, I know that I feel like there was at times where I did extremely well this year, and I feel like there were some downs this year, but I think the consistency and, just the consistency and getting ready and preparing and practicing and just getting myself prepared and ready for next year is all I can do now.
All righty. Thanks again for being on, and we will talk to you next year.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me.
All right. So, Jim, second round of CSJ.
Thanks, Carter. Appreciate it. I hope your off season goes really well. And I enjoyed that, and I certainly hope to have you on the show. I want to have as I'm listening to John's interview, I'm thinking of questions. So now, I guess that's good that my brain still works at this time of the morning. But a couple of points is I think I'm so fascinated. You know, you touched on this. You touched on the idea of, you know, of a younger player, you know, coming up in the system. And I'm used to talking to Japanese guys talking about their adjustments from not so much high school. I don't know what it is about me and not talking to high school guys. I do, but I think it's an automatic transition, or it's an obvious hurdle
mm-hmm.
going from high school baseball to the pros. But I do talk, I've had the discussion with corporate league guys, and even for them, it's really hard because the format's different. And this sure. is different, you know, so they're going from tournament play to, you know, an everyday grind, from intense three, four weeks to 6 months. So those kind of things. But with Carter Stewart Jr., we're in a completely different situation, because not only is he adjusting to pro baseball
mm-hmm.
from amateur baseball, but he's adjusting to pro baseball in a context he's never experienced before. You know, the Japanese guys are with other Japanese guys who've all more or less been through the same cookie cutter kind of system.
Sure.
I mean, every youth team and high school and college is a little different, but they're so used to the same kinds of thing. The culture is I don't want to say it's monolithic. It's probably the U.S. culture is probably as monolithic as uniform.
Sure. There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah. But it's quite different from the way it is in the States. And so when he talked about, you know, everybody staying on an even keel, how important that was. And I was thinking, well, he wouldn't get that lesson in America. Like, nobody would say, you know, that's one of those things that you get as a pro, you know? So I was thinking that I really enjoyed it, because he's looking at, you know, the same game that turning professional, he's going through the same things that people do in the States, except he's, you know, learning these things through a different filter.
Sure. Because, in a pandemic.
Well, yes. And that as well. Yes. But in the sense of dealing with, you know, foreign conceptions or alien conceptions, even of how to get things done, mm-hmm. how the organization expects you to do things. Every organization will be different, and Japanese organizations will be a little different from that, because sometimes they'll say things that don't make any sense to you, because they're just they're not part of your menu, your baseball thought processes.
Right. Sure.
So there was that, and then I guess there's another one I would add to something you mentioned about the, you know, how he uses analytics. And I would say, you know, players aren't good because they have good coaches. Coaches look good because players are good.
Okay.
Which is of course nonsense. You know, players are good because of their combination of strength and skills, you know, including their ability to learn and make use of resources available to them. And I think maybe it was I don't want to be harsh. I think you sort of like misspoke a little bit. But yeah, in the sense that analytic, you know, people's metrics are good because the players are good, which is true, but analytics serve a purpose, which is, as he said, and which most people, who use them now, and the analytics are different from what we started, you know, what they were 10 years ago when we started the podcast, or I should say when you started the podcast.
And brought
me dragged screaming and kicking into it.
You didn't even bother to scream and kick. But anyway, yeah. we'll get into this.
But anyway, my point is this. It's basically just feedback.
Okay.
you know, and I think there are people who are good at using feedback, who are better at using feedback from coaches, and there are people who are better at using feedback from metrics and analytics, and those people can improve because of the feedback. I mean, I'm not going to be able to throw a 100-mile-an-hour fastball. I'm not even going to be able to throw a 50-mile-an-hour fastball, regardless of, you know, what my analytics are. But I could throw better if I had some feedback that was telling me what was working.
I'm not sure how you heard the comment, and we'll save this topic for another day because it could be another debate. But I was saying that, you know, it's not like Babe Ruth was good because
that part I got.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's all that, and certainly those numbers are going to help, and the analytics are going to help improve on what you have, and that's the key, because everybody needs an edge, because most of the guys who get to the top levels of these sports have similar talents. And then there are things that are going to put you over the edge. For instance, preparation. And as Carter talked about, getting ready physically and those other things that are important. And analytics is one of those things that can help give you an edge. But
I'm hypersensitive to it. And I'm hypersensitive to it. And John tends to be, I don't want to say hyper snarky, but that's one of the things you have in the past saved your snark for a little bit.
There's an element of snarkasm that I snipe with a lot, but I mean, it's because I played sports. I don't know how many of these guys who bring a lot of the numbers actually did some of the things that they're talking about. Yeah. That's my whole approach with that thing. But let me hit on a couple of points that I had, and we can move along. Mm-hmm. I liked him discussing the approach of to rooting on teammates with whom he's competing, you know, for an opportunity.
Yep.
There's an old song from the 90s. God, that sounds so weird to say, by the Foo Fighters, in which the lyrics say, "What do you do when all your enemies are friends?" And I think that applies here in the sense that you really want to root for these guys. They are your friends, and you're working toward a goal. But at the same time, these are the guys you're competing against to try to get a spot on the top team. So when you do your best and someone tops it, you can tip your cap. It's like, I guess it's like you can liken it to the home run hitting contest or something like that, in which a guy goes out and hits a bunch of home runs and puts up a number. Now you know what you have to do. And so you step into the box and you try to hit as many at least or top that, sort of that kind of thing. So that when someone does well, you say, okay, now I know what the standard is, and I have to go out there and perform as well. And so it, you know, that whole competitive environment that we see come out when a guy like in one, I think it was game 3 of the Japan series, that Yuya Hasegawa hits a ball to second, and it ends up being a great play by Naoki Yoshikawa of the Giants. And he gets the play at first, and Hasegawa's diving, trying to beat the ball to first base. And Hasegawa ends up, you know, he's out, and he's on his knees looking down as if he had just lost the Japan series. And this is a team that had won consecutive games and was up leading in the series, and his reaction is like, I just blew the whole thing. And it's that competitive spirit. I think that's where it starts. It starts on the farm. It starts in the organization, creating that kind of environment in which these players really compete. They don't just compete with each other. They don't just compete with themselves. They compete with the opponents. They compete with the numbers. They compete, and they're just hyper competitive. And, then I love the fact that Carter talked about finishing off at bats, and that he, you know, he seemed to not be able to do that.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I was thinking, you know, join the club. It's sort of like it's the sort of Greek chorus that goes on whenever we talk to pitchers.
Right, and it's not that easy, and I love that's why I talked about in the opening, saying that, you know, he's working on things. So, you know, he was able to get at least to two strikes. Now he has to figure out a way to get that out, and it doesn't have to. You know, he said put him away. I assume he meant strike him out, but I really think that it's more about getting that weak contact, getting the out, getting the player or the batter to not do what he's trying to do, get him to change something. And get the out. So Carter turned 21 on November 2nd, but I believe he's leaving. He's heading for the States on Monday, the day that we upload the show. So hopefully we can get the show uploaded before he hops on a plane and he can have a listen before while he's on the plane, maybe. But it seems like a lot of work lies ahead for him. Really fun to talk to him. Really great guy. And hopefully, I don't know that it'll even be next year, but we can meet in person and have a sit down chat in the dugout like the old days.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was good. I would add, you know, I'm just the add before we move on. I thought the bit about, you know, the competition in the team is vital. And before we talk about the Japan series, because that's pretty much what we're going to talk about, I think, yeah, with the Hawks, and you mentioned something, and I was mulling it over about, you know, the Hawks don't seem that much better. And I in some ways, I agree. In some ways, I don't. But I think the way I agree is the more I think about it, the more I think you're right in the sense that if you look at other teams, you do see differences. Every organization is different. And Coco Ballantyne said this while we're on a kind of a Hawks-centric gig here, that the Hawks, I think in Japan, on a sort of, on a larger cultural level, there's more than in America, there's a get along, what do you say, go along to get along?
Right, right.
There's a go along to get along. It's agreement within the group is fundamental to survival. In other words, do whatever people tell you, whether it's right or wrong. And I think in baseball, really good baseball player, every good athlete, every good competitor will tell you, yeah, yes, no. No, but Japanese organizations tend toward the, you know, go along to get along. And baseball is really not that different in many ways. And I think one of the things about the Hawks, perhaps the thing about the Hawks, is they're probably the least go along to get along team in Japan.
Mm.
The least accepting of, you know, do it because we do it.
Right. Do it because we do it. Yeah. Well, I think maybe I didn't articulate it well. I wasn't saying that the Hawks are maybe not as talented as
I didn't get that at all.
But what I meant was they don't have the superstar players that we have become accustomed to. There's no Nobuhiko Matsunaga out there who's dominating, we've got Yuki Yanagita, but the teams that Matsunaga was on, it seemed like they had stars all over the place. Koji Akiyama was on one of the teams that when those guys played together. And that's what I mean. It's not like these guys are superstar talent laden team, but they just do so much the right way and do so much better than the other teams.
Well, certainly that image fits this, you know, the last 2 years version as, you know, as the core stars have aged, Seiichi Uchikawa, Nobuhiro Matsuda, and Yuki Yanagita, Kenta Imamiya, as they've gotten in the, you know, closer around, you know, when their ages are grouping around 30 to 33, or in Uchikawa's case, 73. I'm sorry. I'm kidding you, bro.
All right. Well, let's move along.
The point is, they have changed to sort of a different kind of team.
Yes, a team that just doesn't lose Japan Series games. So they swept to their fourth consecutive Japan Series title. They have won 11 in franchise history. They have won now 12 consecutive Japan Series games. I got ahead of myself. I jumped the gun last week with the numbers, but it's now 16 consecutive postseason games they have won. They outscored the Giants 26-4, held them to a Japan worst 132 batting average and the fewest hits with 22. They won game 3-4 behind Matt Moore, who delivers 7 no-hit innings And I thought that was awesome for him. At least, you know, he earned, like I said, another deal from SoftBank or maybe a major league team. You never know. Mm. But I thought this game brought back some wonderful 2007 Japan Series game memories, Game 5 memories.
Oh, yes.
And yes, I was thinking
a little snark coming out in Messenger there.
I you know, someone at our office had this misguided perception at that time that the game is for the amusement of observers. And I said, much like Daisuke Yamai got the hook after 8 perfect innings in 2007, we got fewer innings from Matt Moore. He left after 7, but I didn't at all think at any time he was going to finish that game. And, you know, because it was close, again, it was a 2-0 game so at the time. So I think the first thing that went through my mind was, why don't, when batters overperform in a game, the managers yank them? You know, let's say a guy hits home runs in his first 3 at-bats, the manager says, oh, gosh, well, we can't get any more out of this guy. We got to take him out.
Actually, there was famously a manager who did that in Japan.
Oh, no.
And he's in the Hall of Fame for his managing.
And he's in the Hall of Fame for his managing or mismanaging?
He was one of those guys who didn't really understand probability. And he'd go like, oh, you're 3 for 3 today. You're likely not going to get another hit.
So, yeah, time to sit you down. Well, Matt Moore overperformed. I'm sure they weren't thinking that they were going to get more than 6 innings out of him. And I think I saw between the 6th and 7th innings, they had a discussion. And I'm sure it went something like, this is your last inning, so, you know, blow the doors off of it. I don't even know if Matt had to convince him to let him go out there. But anyway.
Well, I guess I tweeted, I didn't even realize until they mentioned it in the 6th inning that he hadn't allowed a hit.
Yeah, there was some traffic on the bases. Yes,
there were 2 walks and 2 errors, and there were a bunch of balls that could have he gave up a bunch of balls that could have easily been hits and some for extra bases. And so it wasn't like I've seen him sharper than that.
Okay.
So it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like, wow, he's, you know, he's blowing making people think he was Yudai Ohno out there and, you know, in during his 10, you know, 8 game complete game stretch or anything.
Yeah, well, but still, pitchers are treated like, you know, dud hand grenades, you know, that could explode at any moment. We gotta handle with care, and we gotta get them to the locker room and get them in the shower before they explode.
Well, yeah, but of course they took him out after he had a 4-run lead, actually, technically. So
technically, yeah. But
right, yeah. Because the 2 runs scored in the bottom of the 7th.
Right. But
yeah, I think it was, it wasn't a lot of pitches, but I would think that he didn't pitch well in the 6th inning. And I was thinking, I think that was really the key, that he was, well, Kudo said that he was looking a little fatigued, and I don't disagree with that.
Okay. Well, I mean, managers are going to have their reasons, and I was fine with it.
I mean, I thought so, too. I mean, geez,
it looked like Matt was
going to bring out Levon Moinello, so I'm good.
Yeah, yeah. So that was a quick game. Again, 4-0.
My comment on that one was I thought it was about the best game of the series.
Mm.
And I liked it because I thought Daniel Sanchez pitched really well.
He did.
And I think he pitched better than Moore did, but he didn't get the results. And I mean, Moore was fortunate, you know, he got these 2 rockets that were hit that were caught like at the wall. One of them would have scored a run. And it was just sort of there were 3 errors on, you know, the Hawks made 2 errors, Moore made 1 of the errors. And again, that could easily have been a hit, you know, ball coming off the end of his glove.
Sure. Yeah.
So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sort of a picture postcard, but I thought, Sanchez pitched quite well, and he made mistakes. And one of the things I noticed in this, maybe I'll say later, but the part of the game that was really interesting to me was Akira Nakamura, because in the first inning, he had a very atypical at bat. He came up and he swung at the first pitch, a borderline strike. And one of the things, if you watch him a lot, he basically never swings at a pitch that's not in the heart of the strike zone until there are two strikes. Okay. Anything outside is like, oh, what? Why would I, you know, why waste my time? And
right.
So he made an out on the, you know, swinging at a first pitch on the edge of the zone. And then after that, his at-bats were really good. And he crushed a mistake for a home run, for a two-run home run. And then he had another, he had an RBI single on another pitch in a, you know, very solid at-bat. And that was, that was the Hawks.
Yes, it was. And that was,
I mean, that was very much the story of the series.
The Giants played better. They seemed to compete better. And game four, 4-1 win for the Hawks. They did play better again. Mm-hmm. But there was one thing, that one instance where Hayato Sakamoto, the Giants all-star shortstop, made a really nice play,
mm-hmm.
and for the first out of an inning, and he couldn't even muster up the energy to crack a smile or be happy about it, because they were losing the series, and he knew they were going to lose the series, and they were losing in the game.
Yeah, they kept the camera kept focusing him on him in the dugout with this sort of look of complete and total, like,
it wasn't disinterest, but it was shock and awe.
It's disappointment. Yeah.
So again, Yoya Kurihara helped. He was the MVP. He hit .500 in the series. 4-1 game.
All in the first another, two games, basically.
Yeah, Akira Nakamura again. I thought he could have been the MVP.
Coulda.
He did well. And I don't know. There wasn't really much to talk about in this game either. I just very impressed by the professionalism and the way that the Hawks went out there and just clinched it. I mean, you know, it wasn't, they didn't, a little bit of Yui Tomori drama in the ninth inning, but not even that much of that.
No, they stuck with Tsuyoshi Wada, I think, for three innings, and he was really laboring, but he gave, you know, he's one of those guys that pretty much gives you all, if he needs to give you all he's got to keep runs off the board, he gives you all he's got. He doesn't save a lot. And they went to the bullpen, and the bullpen was just dynamite.
Right. So Yuki Yanagita hit a home run, a two-run shot in the first inning, and Takuya Kai cannoned off a shot, a two-run home run in the second inning, and that was it. And no more scoring the rest of the game, and just kind of a neat, quiet, meek Giants team just kind of went down. And I don't know if it was more the greatness of the Hawks or the fact that the Giants, and I said, where's all that Giants pride we see all plastered all over Tokyo Dome?
Well, I thought it was interesting that about halfway through game four, they kept showing fans in the stands. It's like show, you know, it was like, show some pride for Christ's sakes.
Right. Yes. Yeah. That's what it was. It basically was. So, the Hawks win.
They pitched. They had a really good pitching plan against Kazuma Okamoto and Yoshihiro Maru. I mean, Sakamoto put some good swings. I mean, you saw what a really good player Hayato Sakamoto is, because everybody else basically struggled against the pitches, and he put some good swings on some really good pitches.
Yeah. But yeah, you said Okamoto, he just had this look that he carried on his face the entire series of, I don't know if I can do anything.
Yeah. Well, that was,
just the lack of confidence. That. Yeah.
I mean, you see that when players are really confused about what's coming, you can see that. I mean, I remember when Alex Cabrera was chasing his record 56th home run, and they'd start him out. They would start throwing him a foot outside, and by the end of the bat, he was taking pitches straight right down the middle because he wasn't seeing them. He was just seeing, you know, he didn't know what he was looking at anymore.
Right.
And that, and Okamoto had that. They pitched him really well. Some of the, I think some of the best pitches, like Kodai in Kodai Senga's start, he had a really lousy splitter most of the time, but he threw some of his best ones to Okamoto, completely had him fooled.
Yeah. It was not a stellar performance by the Giants, and they did look overmatched and just out talented, you know, on the field. There was nothing that you could look at the game and say, if the Giants had done this strategically,
now,
or if
the
they
Giants
had done that.
Needed a lot of breaks. I thought, well, I mean, I thought going in that I thought they would need a lot of breaks to win, and well, which baseball yeah. happens. Baseball provides opportunities for breaks, but they didn't,
right.
They didn't get as many as they needed.
So, yeah. So as we talk about this, I think we have to bring up the greatness of Kimiyasu Kudo, who practically was announced as the Yokohama manager back in, what was it, 2011? I'm pretty sure, after he retired as a very successful pitcher. According to Wikipedia, he was part of 11 Japan Series winning teams. And
yeah.
Now he has collected 5 championships as a manager of the Hawks, and he's just... You know, I don't know. He's tossing a can of Kudo colored ink all over the record books. I mean, it's going to be covered with his greatness and his name.
Well, I tweeted something about the Hawks, and that they had, you know, something to the effect of they are now the greatest draft era dynasty in Japan. They're really not. Still, that belongs to the Seibu Lions. They mm-hmm. haven't quite matched what the Seibu Lions did. They're certainly the greatest free agent era dynasty.
Yeah, but I'm not saying it's all him.
No, of course I know you're not.
Yeah, a lot to do.
You didn't say that.
No, but he is now very much the model of a modern major general. He said someone from the Pirates of the Penzance.
Johnny Gilbert and Sullivan.
he is amazing. And I couldn't help but think of the Bay Stars and think that they could have had. And I'm glad Yokohama I'm glad that the Bay Stars eventually got Alex Ramirez, and I think they did a lot of great things. But I think this could have been a franchise changing move had they gotten him. And like I said, I don't think it's all him, but obviously he plays a huge role and has huge impact on players.
I think so. I mean, he's sort of a combination of intense and easygoing.
Perfectly put.
In that he's a very joyful individual who believes in really hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, with DNA is, you know, he said it was sort of a mismatch, and they wanted exactly the same things, but Kudo wanted to be the boss. He wanted to be in charge. He didn't want he didn't want the front office telling him what to do. And
something I really, really appreciate now. But anyway,
# high
heat. Keep going.
So, but no, I agree. I think he's done he's done a great job. He said, you know, I asked him about it, I guess 2 years ago, and we were talking in November at an old timers game, and I said, you know, tell me about that was the year he. Basically, he did one of those bullpen inversions where mm-hmm. he ran out of starting pitchers. So he took all his struggling starting pitchers, threw them into the bullpen, and brought in 3 relievers and made them starters.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, brought guys up from the farm. But basically, he chucked out his underperforming starters and threw them in the bullpen, like a whole bunch
right.
of them. And I said, you know, where was the idea for that? He said, that was all the coach's idea. you know, that was a coach's ideas. That wasn't. And so I said, well, was that easy to do, to learn how to listen to the coaches? He says, not at all. But it's sort of like the big thing I've learned as a manager is listen to the coaches.
Right. Right. All right. Well, fantastic performance. Congratulations to the Hawks and everybody in the organization, including Carter and the fans. I'm sure they're reveling. And I just want to make mention of this, too, because I think I tweeted it out. I thought the subdued celebration at the end of the series was, I don't know, it might have reminded me of a preseason game even, because I had seen more excitement from the Hawks after a walk-off victory in a regular season than what they showed on this night. But they're just used to winning, and we've got COVID. We've got the COVID situation as well, so I think it was just all subdued, and I think part of that was because of the pandemic. But certainly they just look like ho-hum. We'll see you guys here next year. You know?
So just, I guess the last Hawks streak was they haven't lost. The one thing, now I'm a big fan of Tsuyoshi Wada, as everybody knows. And the one thing I was hoping was that they would win game four once he started, because I didn't want their, 16 game home Japan series winning streak to be bookended by losses by Tsuyoshi Wada.
Oh, I see.
He lost. The streak started in game six. Yeah, the 2011 Japan series.
Wow.
Where through the first six games, the visiting team won every game.
That was the Chunichi series.
It was the Chunichi series. The Dragons won the first three. Well, they won the first two games in Fukuoka. The Hawks won the three games in Nagoya. And the Dragons won game six before the Hawks won the decider.
Good times. All right, let's move along. Make a four-seam transition and talk about the Sawamura Award, which was handed out this past Monday. So if you're listening on Monday, a week ago. And the Curmudgeon Crew got it right. And I just didn't see any way that they could not vote for Yudai Ono of the Chunichi Dragons. I mean, he had the numbers, but he also had the benchmarks, which they had to alter, modify.
Well, they didn't alter them. They said, no benchmarks this year. You just go. You guys go.
Right, which meant they just kind of threw him in the trash. But that for me, that's modification. I mean,
okay.
They always modify. They didn't come out with numbers.
Nobody meets them all rarely.
Right. Yeah. So Ono, who had 10 complete games, he threw 148 and two-thirds innings and had a 1.82 ERA, winning his second ERA title in a row. And he pitched the most innings, I believe, in the Central League, and had 148 strikeouts. And his whip was 0.87. I mean,
that's Devo caliber whip.
Yeah. And he went 11-6 on a team that finished, had a really good chance to finish second place, but finished third. And so I thought he met all the criteria he was ludicrous. Let's call it what it was. It was unexpected. It was something I commented on the show. I'm like, nobody wants to see Ono come out, and he's not a big draw, and he's not really ace level, and blah, blah, blah. I said all these bad things. And then he had a turnaround game in which he gave up a mammoth home run to Munetaka Murakami of the Yakult Swallows, and looked like he was headed for maybe even deactivation if he didn't start to turn his game around. And he turned that game. He ended up finishing that game off. The Dragons scored some runs and came back, and they won. And that was it. He really never looked back after that. He was just as shut down, as close to, you know, Sawamura, I guess, as any pitcher could get. And out of nowhere, he's 32 years old. It's going to be hard to repeat this.
Oh yeah.
As he's going forward, but. You know, he just had one of those stretches in a season that is weird anyway. And I'm so glad, you know, I'm not big on the postseason awards. You know, I think some of them are meaningful in Japan. I'm not even sure what the MVP, if it's meaningful or not to the people who vote on it, because they don't seem to get it right most of the time. But I thought this was a huge thing for him, and I was glad for him.
I was intrigued. I was watching the press conference Okay, I'll be precise. I was listening to the press conference. The monitor was turned away from me. And three of the five members, or I should say at least two of the five members of the Somera selection committee of five pitchers who were older than me, they were basically came in with, we should have, two of them came in, we should have Sugano and Ohno be joint winners.
Oh, I didn't. Yeah, I heard that they mentioned that.
And they were steered away by the chairman, Tsuneo Horiuchi, who's probably the number two curmudgeon on that group. He's a funny cat. I mean, he's just a wonderful, nice guy. And he's just, but he gets so irate sometimes. And he said, no, we should have the best one. And, but the debate came down to whether we shouldn't give it to Sugano because he won so many more games than everybody else.
Right.
And he won, he set the Japan record.
that was not the Japan record, right? Yeah.
He set the Japan record for wins in a season of consecutive
there
wins.
There were like six qualifiers on that thing.
Yeah, no, he set,
that's not a record.
Yeah, he set the Japan record for wins from the start of a season by a player born on October 11th. Happy birthday to you. So, okay, so there was that. So it was basically, oh, well, if we have to give it to one person, well, I guess then we have to give it to Ohno. And there was a little bit of that. They did discuss the other guys. Basically, they discussed the other pitchers who were close to the wins leader.
Mm-hmm.
In the three, they actually discussed Masato Morishita, and they mentioned the other 11 game winners in the Pacific League. So, okay. Yeah, who cares?
Yep. Yeah.
So
yeah,
that was that.
This was Ono's award, and so I'm glad they got it right.
Yeah,
so.
I think everybody was happy with that. Sugano did not have a great – he had a very good season. I mean, the thing about Sugano is that he cruises so much that he makes it look easy until he doesn't have to, and then he cruises. He gives the impression he's not like – I don't know. He's disinterested or he's not really trying – I mean, you know,
he's working on things,
but he's economical. And sometimes that sort of detracts from his image, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, making a two seam transition, because we're going to continue to talk about Sugano.
I thought we were going to talk about Ohno with the two seamer. Okay. So,
good one. Good one. We've got free agent talk and poster boy talk. So, it was announced this past week that Tomoyuki Sugano is probably going to be posted, although it hasn't become official yet. Right?
The Giants have said he can go if he wants.
Okay. So, that's big.
They're going to talk this. They were supposed to talk this week and decide. So.
Okay, so that's big news because that would make it two consecutive years that the Giants have posted a player after never having done so in the posting era.
And they said they have not changed their policy towards the posting system. They still don't recognize it.
Oh, they're not changing their policy.
No. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope,
well, they posted Shun Yamaguchi last year. So now Sugano's 31.
Yep.
And remember, he sat out a year because he was drafted. I think Nippon Ham selected him. And the team tried to
in 2011, right? And he 2011 sat out the 2012 season
tried to convince him to join that team, but he wanted to play for his uncle and the Giants, so he sat out.
The irony is, of course, if he had gone to play for the Fighters, he would have been in the major leagues 4 years ago.
Take that. I'm trying to project what he would be, and I was looking around the internet, and I found one place that maybe projected him as a number three, but I was also thinking about some of the teams that might be interested. And also Kohei Arihara of Nippon Ham is also on deck to be posted. Or is that official now?
He wants to go. He's going to be posted. Yeah, that is okay. Official.
And so Sugano, I would say, rates higher than Arihara. But Arihara is younger, and I think that counts big in MLB. And MLB is really high on velocity and more heat. So,
well, Sugano throws relatively hard. He's not a flamethrower, but he throws hard. You know.
Yeah, but I don't think Arihara is a consistent hard thrower. I would actually project him as, you know, it depends on the team. So I was looking at the teams, and I thought maybe many of the playoff teams from this pandemic season would be interested in a pitcher from Japan because they all seem to be short on pitching. And starting with the Chicago White Sox, I thought they were exposed that they didn't have enough pitching when they got into the playoffs. I think the Blue Jays might be interested, especially because they got Yamaguchi.
Yeah.
The Braves could be interested. The Rays could be interested, especially because they're a frugal team. If they don't have to pay a lot of money, and they could get somebody like Arihara and use him as an opener, maybe two, three times a week. I think, you know, that's something they might consider. The San Diego Padres, the San Francisco Giants would be a really good spot, I thought, for Sugano, because that team has money and a huge Japanese following anyway, or Japanese community up there. And then the Marlins, I thought, might take a swing because they're a team that needs pitching as well. So those are the teams I thought might show some interest in.
I think most of the teams are going to be interested in, you know, in seeing what kind of deal they could make for Sugano. I don't think there's a major league team that he wouldn't improve. Of course, it depends on how much. I mean, the people I talked to pretty much said, yeah, number two or three starter on most teams, maybe number four on a championship team.
Okay.
Left a really good impression on the major league scouts in the 2017 WBC when he pitched superb innings in the semifinal against the United States that Japan ended up losing.
Yeah, but that was a year ago. That was a while ago, and he has incurred some physical problems.
Well, yeah, he had the back trouble. He's had a couple of things. He's had shoulder. I'm not looking at my website right now. That's if you want to know, that's where to look. Got his whole injury report there.
But oh, okay.
It's he's been pretty consistent. I mean, as far as his pitching goes, yeah, he's remarkably consistent. He's basically been he had lower back trouble last year, and he probably shouldn't have been pitching at the end of the season. It was like he shouldn't have been warming up in Game 4 if they were going to use him in Game 5.
We didn't mention that. The Giants had to activate him before the game,
sure,
or get him on the active list before the game. So if they're going to do that, they might as well pitch him. So anyway.
That was more mysteries. But I think, if he wants to go, he's going to be able to get a pretty good deal. I mean, some teams will not be willing to match the price he wants.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand Sugano is represented by Wasserman, which is the same agency that has, I believe, which I know has Yoshitomo Tsutsugo, and I believe has Yu Darvish.
Okay.
So I think he'll go. I think if he wants to go. I mean, of course, the question is John and I were talking about this before the season. I know Deanna Rubin was chiming in. It's like, why would anybody in their right mind want to go to the United States right now? And I certainly have to agree with her because the coronavirus is certainly, I mean, compared to Japan where it's out of control, in America, it's a mad, mad, mad world. I'm in Japan. So I can understand if a player, I know Ayumu Ishikawa of the Marines, that was a factor in his decision not to go because the Marines were willing to post him.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll keep an eye on that and I'll keep my ear to the ground and try to talk to some of the people I know as well. And as far as the free agents in Japan, we're not going to mention them all, but I did want to highlight the fact that Yakult ace Yasuhiro Ryan Ogawa is going to test the market. And I don't know. I think obviously the Swallows need pitching, and Ogawa has been considered one of their top pitchers. I mean, he doesn't get opening day all the time. It's always Masanori Ishikawa.
Who's their nominal ace, yeah.
Right. But Ogawa testing the market, I don't know. He threw a no-hitter this season, past season.
Yeah, he threw a no-hitter, and he was the first pitcher to throw – He was the first pitcher to throw a no-hitter who had never struck out 10 batters in a game before.
Wow.
Did he strike out 10 that day? In that game. It was the only time game he's ever struck out 10 batters in a game.
Yeah, because I remember. And it was exactly 10, wasn't it?
I believe it was, yes.
Yeah, I thought it was. So
that was his career high. So he's a quality pitcher. He knows what he's doing. I mean, he had a terrible year last year.
In 2019.
And he had a very good year this year. So there would certainly be interest. I think he would look really good on a good team.
Yeah. He managed a winning record 10-8 with the Swallows, even though his ERA was a career worst this year. But I mean, there are a lot of factors with that as well. And I mean, good luck to him. I actually think he could be useful for some teams, especially teams that play good defense. So I don't think he's missing the mark by trying to test the market.
No, I think a lot of teams. I think Nippon Ham Fighters would be a team that would be interested. Cebu Lions for sure. And then also, two others we have is Takayuki Kajitani of DeNA and his teammate, starting pitcher Shoichi Ino, who's been a very I don't know. He's been a very inconsistent pitcher. I mean, but he's one of these guys who's some days he's lights out and some day he's dog meat. I mean, he's inconsistent. He has been inconsistent in the past, but he's got quality stuff. I mean, he certainly has the ability to throw exceptional pitches.
You should have said some days he's lights out and other days he's lit up.
I should have said that. It's a good thing you did.
I've got your back, man.
I know you do. Sometimes things sticking out.
Yeah. You know, 34. I don't know about that either in terms of testing the market, but he might just want to change the environment.
And I think he also might just want a better contract from DeNA. I mean, that's part of the deal too, is you get to go home and you get a contract that, suits your market value.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you really do know what your market value is. So I think there's that. Even if half the players or a third of the players will turn around and go home again,
right? And by home you mean stay with their original team. So, all right. So making a seamless transition, we do this each year. We talk about our favorite moment from the season once the season has completed. And I sent a note to you early on in the week to remind you about it. And I hope you had enough time to come up with something that really kind of represents this season for you.
I never have enough time because
make some. I got a time factory.
That's me. Okay. I'll stop all that sleeping. Excess sleeping and lounging around. My favorite moment of the season, it's kind of ironic, and was July 31st this year, and it was really a remarkable day. A lot of sort of streaks ended and started and continued that day, and that was the streak that ended. And this is just trivia, was Zach Neale's consecutive winning decision streak ended that day. And this one went way down. In fact, it was the last game I wrote about on my blog. I was writing long sort of game stories that night. I must have been off. And I got one at the end where it's Viciado saves Dragons Ohno with a two-run home run. And this was the game that John mentioned, the one where Yudi Ohno gave up a really monster home run to Munetaka Murakami of the Swallows at Nagoya Dome. And the thing that's kind of struck me at the time, because I was so impressed by Ohno the week before when he allowed one run in five innings in a loss at Koshien Stadium when he left the game and it was 1-0. And I think it turned out to be a 3-1 game or something. But it was a game that was very winnable. And it was a game where he pitched really, really well. In fact, I was really impressed by his pitching in this game he lost. And then he comes out and he doesn't pitch nearly as well. But what he did was he pitched very efficiently. And then he said in one of the hero interviews, I don't know what it is about me remembering hero interviews. I think as you get older, it's maybe a senility thing. But he said, the announcer said, "What did you do that made you a winner today when you weren't a winner last week?" You know, he went 0-3 to start the season. He says, "Nothing. I pitched," he said. "Basically, I pitched well all year," which was kind of overstating it because he didn't pitch well the first couple of games, the first two games. But he pitched well most of the beginning of the year. "What I failed to do was hang around in the games until my team scored runs," which at the beginning of the season would have meant hanging around until next week because they weren't scoring a lot of runs. So,
yep.
But, you know, he said that, and see, he said, "I came out basically decided to be efficient, to get guys out, to move on and stay in the game, you know, stay in the game as long as I could." And that struck me. I mean, it struck me as being very honest. And I love hero interviews that are honest because they're kind of rare.
Right, they can be, yeah.
And he also has that kind of deadpan, self-deprecating, understated style that I just love. And he was the player who probably was who I was most excited about this year. And so that, and watching that game and watching the week before, and that was probably my big moment of the season. And I mean, it was big even at the time when he didn't pitch great. But when he went on to pitch great, I kept looking back and doing a little fist, you know, pump, kind of like, yeah, good for you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was, I definitely remember that game. And like I said, that started that whole streak for Ohno. So
yeah, eight straight complete games.
Right. So, awesome. Okay. So for me, it was October 13th and it was a game at Zozo Marine Stadium. And it was a player who I've, you know, looked at as, maybe not an underachiever, but someone whose expectations, maybe were a lot higher than I thought maybe should have been, given his physical makeup. But it's Seiya Chubbs Inoue, and he had a walk-off double in the ninth inning to beat Rakuten 4-3. And
he was,
you know, crying. you know how I feel about the crying and all the other stuff and all the emotion.
You and the other Chubbs.
But but for me, this game, it you know, watching him and the way he went down on one knee and raised both arms in the air and really just proceeded to break down emotionally out there on the bases. And it coincided with the struggle he has endured. You know, he's had these huge expectations, but just hasn't been able to satisfactorily meet those expectations. Then you've had, you know, the coronavirus and the fact that it hit the I think it was soon after that or around that time that Lotte had experienced a bunch of a cluster breakout of the virus. And so to see him with his arms raised like that, it was a thrill for me to watch him. And it just kind of represented the Marines this season. They just didn't have a lot of expectations. I think when we talked about them in the preseason, a lot of the guys we had on the show, except for Steve, the guy who writes the blog, didn't really have a lot of great things to say about the team, but I did see something there, and I did have some expectations, not necessarily from him, but that's that underdog story, you know, and I think a lot of people like that underdog story, and I think that's what this season was, kind of, because I didn't really know that. I had my doubts that we would get a season in. I had my doubts that we would not have to have a pause in the season.
Mm.
And we got through it all. And I think that, you know, those arms raised like that, it shows that, and we were able to crown a champion here in November, late November, but nonetheless get it done. And you know, everybody has been talking about every league that has played any sports, you know, worldwide. It's an amazing achievement to get it done. And they did. And I'll just remember that from this season, because
yeah, we only had one team president to quit over the,
I'm sorry.
And we only had one team president quit over infections at his team.
Only one. Yeah.
I would add to that. Another memorable moment was when the Giants clinched the pennant and Tatsunori Hara said, you know, in addition to the, routine stuff, oh, the players prepared well, and this was a remarkable season, and we, you know, we were so determined this year, and so on and so forth, and so on and on and on. And then he said, you know, because of the way the season came about, I've never been more proud to be involved with professional baseball than I was this year.
Yep. Yeah. Tough year. It really has been, but we've gotten through it. So let's go to fielding questions. All right. So this is a comment that we got from Michael Westbay. I'll say that he lives in Yokohama, but I don't know the city.
He does live in Yokohama. It's not in the heart of the city. It's
okay.
But it is technically Yokohama.
Okay, so he sent an email to both Jim and myself, and he says, "Hey, John and Jim, I forgot to mention that along with the report of expanding the number of fans, it was noted that there was one person who attended a game later diagnosed with COVID-19. Contact tracing information required at all the venues didn't turn up anyone else being infected from that game, but the date and venue were not publicly announced. As much as I would like to believe that a wide area of people who sat near the infected person were contacted, the fact that the date and venue have not been released is my main objection to the way this was handled. The public deserves more openness." And so we got this a while back when I think I made a comment about the fact that they were trying to expand the number of fans at Yokohama Stadium to test, as a test or a trial, to see how they could control the spread with gatherings, so that next year when the Olympics are held, that they could have a better idea of how to manage the situation. And I thought, this is ridiculous. This is human trials with a killer disease or killer infection. What are we doing here? And so I think that was in response to this. So I wholeheartedly agree, Michael. There's no transparency. There's no even attempt at transparency. No trusting the process, so to speak. And the whole problem, I think, with this premise is that it's based on symptoms and confirmation of the illness. So that if you say this person went to a game and this person was infected, that if someone else turned up at a hospital, that you would know that other people were infected. And that's not the case, because you can be asymptomatic and simply spread it, so that someone who went to the game and spread it to other people at their office or on a train or somewhere else, and those people ended up going to a hospital, there's no contact tracing that would offer confirmation that that was the source of the infection. So it's very disturbing to me that this was the way that they went about it, all in the name of having the Olympics next year. And, you know, I still don't see how they can have an Olympics where they invite teams and staff and chefs and all the people who come with a team and have them come from hundreds of countries to participate in the Olympics. not in this environment, not right now. I can't see how that would happen. Jim.
Well, I certainly, transparency is always hard because of issues with, privacy issues.
Mm-hmm.
And Japan's government has trouble with, telling people to stay home because the Constitution prevents the police from arresting people who don't stay home. So it's always hard. But yeah, transparency is always, as John and I have talked about, NPB has sort of followed whatever the government has said. When the government has said there's no coronavirus problem, NPB said there is none. As soon as they said there is, they said, of course there is. They've pretty much been sheep. And I want to say they've acted well, but the government has, with the exception of I don't know the truth, but I have to say that the way the numbers were released about COVID infections in February and March suggests that the government was intentionally reducing the number of reported infections. And the reason I say this is because until March 23rd, every day the infections nationwide were in single digits. 1, 2, 3, 4, 8, 6. And then on March 24th, they skyrocketed. They suddenly went to like 70 or 80. And I'm trying to remember, but I think March 24th was the day they decided that they had to postpone the Olympics.
Yeah.
Until then, we're taking care of it. It's not going to be a problem. And as soon as that was out of the way, it says, okay, well, let's move on to the next problem, which is taking care of the coronavirus for a change.
Right.
I don't want to be, I don't know that happened, but it certainly looks like they had been squashing the curve. they've been flattening the curve in their sort of own way.
Yeah. We talked to players all season long, and I can tell you that no fewer than 3 players told me the same thing.
Okay.
Off the record. So, they were concerned and they had a mistrust in the numbers that were being given, and they let me know off the record.
Okay. Yeah. So it's largely, there's
Olympic,
I don't think
driven
country,
jibber jabber.
Yeah. Well, I think there's no country where the coronavirus is not somewhat of a political football, and compared to the United States, we were fortunate. It's only the Olympics.
Right. Right. Okay, people. Well, we had a very COVID impacted season here, and we have pushed forward, but we are going to take a little bit of a break now. Jim told me that the MVPs, the announcement is set for December 17th. So if that's wrong, blame Jim. But
you can blame me if it's right.
Okay, we'll credit you if it's right. How's that? We will take a little bit of a break, but we will come back after the MVP announcement, and then we will disappear into our off-season training program, which features a lot of NFL football for me. And we'll include some NBA basketball as well. But we appreciate you listening through the whole season. Thank you very much.
Yes, I hope all of you could stay healthy and your loved ones are also safe.
Definitely, definitely. So we will talk to you in a couple of weeks, maybe more. Enjoy your off season.
Keep enjoying your baseball around the world. It never stops.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. Be sure to send in your questions with hashtag #HighHeat, and you'll hear from us again next week.